Good morning, everyone. It's great to see so many people in the FCC at this time of the morning. I don't think I've ever seen that before. It's my great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Ms. Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland today. Hong Kong has very deep and historic ties with Scotland, and that also extends to the FCC. This building that we're in here was originally a cold storage depot for Dairy Farm, which was a company that was founded by a Scottish surgeon called Sir Patrick Manson. And in 1982, this building became our home when we moved into it under the, at the behest of the then governor, Sir Murray McLehose, who was born in Glasgow. So our connections run to today, and we have many Scottish members, and I can see quite a few here today. I'd now like to hand over to Ms. Sturgeon to talk to us. She's the first woman to serve as Scottish First Minister, and after an election in which her Scottish National Party won 56 out of 59 seats in Scotland last year, the British political landscape has changed considerably in the past few months. Ms. Sturgeon.
Good morning, everybody. Lovely to see you all here. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Thank you, Neil, for your introduction, and a massive thank you to the Foreign Correspondents Club for hosting this event. I didn't realise the connections to Scotland that this very building had, so it's interesting to hear that. This is my first visit to Hong Kong, first, I have no doubt, of many. So it is a real pleasure to be here. And as Neil has not just said, but outlined, Scotland and Hong Kong have many links. Many of them go back generations. These ties can be seen as well as in this building, in the Macintosh tartan of the Hong Kong Police Force, pipes and drums, the thistle of the Jardine Matheson Group emblem, and in many place names. One of the first street signs I noticed in my journey in from the airport was Edinburgh Place. So clearly the links are many, varied and long-standing. But since I arrived here yesterday afternoon, what struck me much more than these historic links has been the strength of the modern connections between Scotland and Hong Kong. I've already been involved in discussions on collaboration between Scotland and Hong Kong on issues such as healthy ageing, low carbon technology, and the future of cities. The first engagement I undertook here was to open a new centre out at the Science Park on low carbon innovation with the involvement of Edinburgh University and Napier University. So these links, again, are many and they are varied. There's massive interest here in Scottish products, fashion, food and drink. I would expect at this time of the morning that there's no whiskey on the tables, but perhaps as the day progresses, that might change. But the thing I've been struck by most of all is the warmth of the welcome that I have received absolutely everywhere I've gone over the past few days. So I'm not surprised at all that there's significant interest here about recent developments in Scotland, about, in short, the sea change which has taken place over recent months in the politics of Scotland. And in speaking to you about these developments, I'm going to set out some of the implications of the events of the past year or so, the implications for Scotland itself, but also for the UK as a whole. But I thought it was worthwhile just starting with some background, because a sea change, after all, a transformation created by the sea, doesn't just happen overnight. It's usually the consequence of currents that have been at work over many years, or indeed many generations. And that's certainly very true of the transformation that we have seen in Scotland. The last year in Scotland has certainly been dramatic, but there is a very deep, strong historical context to what has happened over the past year. There's been a desire for many decades for Scotland to have more autonomy. In 1885, that desire for more autonomy led to the establishment of the post of Secretary of State for Scotland within the United Kingdom government. In the 1940s and 50s, 2 million people signed up to what was called the Scottish Covenant, a petition for home rule for Scotland. In 1979, there was a referendum on devolution. What is not always appreciated about the referendum that took place in 1979 is that people in Scotland voted yes to devolution in that referendum, but the aspirations of the people then were blocked by a technicality. But then in 1997, the movement proved to be unstoppable. People voted overwhelmingly to re-establish a Scottish Parliament that had been in abeyance since 1707. And that Scottish Parliament, the Parliament in which I'm proud to sit as a member, has subsequently established itself very firmly as the centre point and the focus of Scottish political and civic life. It's quite interesting, actually, to note the results of a social attitude survey that is conducted every year in Scotland. But the most recent one that was conducted shows that almost 60% of people say they trust the Scottish Government to act in Scotland's interests. The corresponding figure for the UK Government in that survey was 26%. Now, at a very basic level, that's because, at least in part, the Scottish Parliament is physically much closer to the people that it represents than the UK Parliament could ever be. After all of the members of the Scottish Parliament represent Scottish constituencies. At Westminster, fewer than 10% of people who sit in the House of Commons represent people in Scotland. In addition to that, the Scottish Parliament is elected by proportional representation, so its composition much more closely mirrors the views of the people who elect it. The Parliament has also made a very deliberate and major effort to be accessible, to be part of Scotland, not as many parliaments in many parts of the world seem to be, institutions that almost sit apart from the people that they serve. You know, in the last year alone, the Scottish Parliament has hosted more than 400 civic organisations from across Scotland who've come to our Parliament to hold events there to bring their concerns and their priorities directly to the heart of our democracy. The procedures for the Scottish Parliament are very different from those at Westminster. They're less old-fashioned, for a start. The standing orders, the committee system, even the physical layout of the chamber all place a much greater emphasis on building consensus and on consulting around policy. And since I became First Minister, I've very deliberately set my ministers the challenge of being the most open and accessible government that we are able to be. My cabinet, every couple of months, meets in a location outside of Edinburgh, often in a remote or rural part of Scotland. And after we've conducted the business of government and the cabinet meeting, we hold open public meetings where citizens can come and put us on the spot, bring their concerns directly to us. So that's a very distinctive approach to doing politics that has been taken in Scotland. But that distinctive approach to doing politics is matched by a distinctive policy agenda. In recent years, we've seen UK governments in England fragment and partially privatise the National Health Service, raise fees for university education, and implement budget cuts that have hit the lowest income, most vulnerable members of society the hardest. By contrast to that, the Scottish Parliament, not just under the government I lead, or the one Alex Salmond led, but under successive governments, have pursued more progressive policies. We've vigorously promoted economic growth. Indeed, the focus of my visit to China and Hong Kong this week is very much on creating economic opportunity. And that focus pays dividends. At present, Scotland has higher employment, lower unemployment, higher economic activity than the rest of the UK. But we've also been able to promote social justice alongside economic development. The Scottish Parliament has introduced what has been considered to be world-leading legislation to tackle the plight of homelessness. We reintroduced state-funded university education. We legislated for equal marriage, passed the most ambitious climate change targets anywhere in the world. We've taken a very strong action to deal with Scotland's sometimes poor relationship with alcohol and invested heavily to expand and transform early years education and care. And whereas the UK government often sounds, particularly at the moment, hostile to the European Convention on Human Rights, in Scotland, the basic standards set out in the Convention are actually part of the founding legislation of our Parliament. So overall, within Scotland, we have a Parliament that has demonstrated a twin commitment to economic development and social justice, and that has resonated very strongly with people across the country. Now, the reason I've explained that background is because it's impossible, in my view, to understand last year's referendum and the significant support for independence that that referendum demonstrated without recognising that it was partly a consequence of the distinctiveness of Scotland's political culture and the success of the Scottish Parliament since it was established in 1999. But I think it's also important to recognise that the referendum has actually become a cause of further democratic engagement as well as being a consequence of it. And that's because the referendum inspired a quite extraordinary level of enthusiasm and energy. It was recognised around the world as a model of peaceful democratic engagement. The turnout was the highest for any vote on such a scale ever seen in the UK. Everyone realised that in that referendum they had a vote that counted and a decision that really mattered. People got to imagine the different possible futures available to them and to the country, and that turned out to be a hugely powerful and inspiring process, including for many people who had never before participated in any way in the democratic process. And the effects of that have lasted. Politics in Scotland has been transformed over the past year. Some political parties have seen a substantial increase in their membership. Membership of my political party, the SNP, has gone from 25,000 on the day of the referendum to more than 110,000 today. Voter turnout in Scotland in the recent UK election was 5 percentage points higher than in the UK as a whole. And of course, the results of that election in Scotland were quite extraordinary. My party went from having 6 of Scotland's 59 seats in the House of Commons to having 56 of Scotland's 59 seats. Now, that election result didn't provide a mandate for a further independence referendum, but it did reaffirm the importance of Scotland having a much stronger voice in UK affairs. And it left no doubt about the desire of people in Scotland for a more powerful Scottish Parliament. And just to touch briefly on two questions that I get asked often these days, even here in Hong Kong, will there be another independence referendum? And if so, when will it be? My answer to that is quite simple. It will be if and when the Scottish people decide, not a moment before. No politician can impose a referendum on Scotland, no matter how much some of us might like Scotland to be independent. And the reverse is also true. If the Scottish people do vote in future to have another referendum, no politician has a right to stand in the way of that. However, even though the question of whether or not we will become an independent country one day is one I can't answer with certainty today, although I believe we will, there is one issue that is beyond doubt. The result of the recent UK election has significant implications for the whole of the UK, and not just because of what happened in Scotland. The fact is that in May, there were in effect 4 different election campaigns in the 4 different nations of the UK, and they each delivered different results. That needs to be reflected now in how the UK is governed. And whether it is or not may well shape how Scotland sees the question of independence in years to come. And I'm going to briefly touch on 3 issues which will, no doubt amongst many others, test whether the Westminster system of government is or is not capable of being reformed to better reflect Scotland's needs. First of those is the forthcoming referendum on the UK's membership of the European Union. The Scottish Government has argued for a double majority provision in that referendum, which would mean that the UK would only be able to exit the EU if each nation of the UK voted to leave. The absence of such a democratic lock would mean that because the population of England is so much bigger than any other part of the UK, bigger, in fact, than the other three UK nations combined, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland could find ourselves on the way out of the EU even if we had voted to stay in. That wouldn't be acceptable, but it is a possible scenario. Support for the EU has consistently been stronger in Scotland than in England in recent years. So if in Scotland we faced exit from the European Union effectively against our will, something which polling suggests could happen, it wouldn't be at all surprising if that then caused a swell of demand for a further independence referendum. Now, the UK government could remove that possibility completely by agreeing to the double majority provision. And in doing so, they would demonstrate what they very often preach, but less often practice, that the UK is a family of distinct nations, all with equal status and respect. The second example relates to a key promise that was made by all of the main Westminster parties immediately before the independence referendum, a promise to deliver a more powerful Scottish Parliament. Legislation to give additional powers to the Scottish Parliament is currently being considered by Westminster. And MPs from Scotland have put forward a large number of amendments to strengthen that legislation, but not a single one of those amendments has been accepted. The proposals of parties, SNP, Labour, the Liberal Democrats, which together represent 58 of 59 Scottish constituencies, have been disregarded and blocked by a party, the Conservatives, that represents one Scottish constituency. Now, that seems to me to be a deeply unsatisfactory response to how Scotland voted in the general election and suggests an unwillingness or inability on the part of the UK government to adapt to clearly changing circumstances. And the final issue I want to touch on is a policy called English Votes for English Laws, which is not the best choice of names because it's quickly become known in the UK as evil. But what that policy means is that MPs from Scotland would be excluded from certain votes in the House of Commons that are certified by the Speaker of the House of Commons as affecting England only. Now, I recognise that in an era of devolved government for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, that might on the face of it seem reasonable. And properly implemented, it would be reasonable. But because of the financial arrangements that govern the UK, issues which might appear to relate only to England often in reality turn out to have significant financial implications for other parts of the UK. You know, if you look at very quickly at how the UK government's proposals for EVIL would have applied if they had operated in the previous House of Commons, Scottish MPs would have been excluded from votes on 13 pieces of legislation that impacted directly on Scotland and from many more that had financial consequences for Scotland. Again, that wouldn't be acceptable. Now, I said earlier that what happened in Scotland means that there must be change to how the UK is governed. And I recognise that that might mean greater autonomy for England as well, and I welcome that. But it has to be done in a way that respects all parts of the UK and doesn't just reflect the Westminster view of the world. And if that doesn't happen, if Scotland finds itself disenfranchised in the House of Commons on issues that really matter to us, more people in Scotland may well conclude that Westminster is incapable of genuine reform that better reflects our aspirations. So to conclude, that brings me back to the currents that are driving this sea change in Scotland. There is a new political dynamic in Scotland, and responded to positively, it has the potential to benefit every part of the UK. It has the potential to be an opportunity for all of us. For the UK government, in my view, it's an opportunity to rethink a mindset and a model of government that has been far too centralised for far too long. And for Scotland, the sense of possibility is even greater. I've already spoken about the enthusiasm and the engagement that we saw on both sides of the debate in the referendum. That reflects the fact that Scotland has grown since devolution into a confident, innovative and aspirational country. In fact, one of the things I've noticed here in Hong Kong and throughout China earlier in the week is how aware people are of Scotland's capability and potential. And that's actually in part another consequence of last year's vote. We now currently have a higher international profile than we've had perhaps forever, but certainly for decades. People around the world know that in addition to our history, our scenery, our whiskey, our golf, we have talented people, world-class universities, extraordinary natural resources, and real strengths in some of the key economic sectors of the future. So we've now got all of those great assets, and if we can couple them with real powers for our parliament and one of the most politically engaged populations anywhere in the world, then we can do genuinely great things. We've got the chance to use our international profile to encourage investment, boost our exports, promote human rights, and strengthen friendships across the world. And it also gives us the opportunity, indeed the obligation, I would argue, to take the passion that was so obvious during the referendum and apply it to tackling our social challenges and to seizing our vast economic opportunities. And if we can achieve that, then the sea change in Scottish politics will lead to a much more fundamental sea change. It will enable us to create a stronger democracy, a fairer society, and a more prosperous economy. And that will bring benefits for Scotland, but also for the UK as a whole. So those are my thoughts on what's happening in Scotland. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering some of your questions.
Thank you very much, First Minister. When I have questions, please try and keep them brief and to the point. I will take the privilege of stealing the first one, since I have the microphone. You've just been in Beijing. Before the referendum, Chinese leaders came out and urged Scotland to stay in the UK. Was that on your discussion agenda with the State Councillor, Yang Jiechi?
It's not been an issue that's been discussed in any detail at all during my visit to China. I mean, the focus of this visit is an economic focus. You know, I don't think my views on Scottish independence need to be explained or outlined. I think they're pretty well known. But when I come on trips like this, the message that I bring is a very simple one. Regardless of Scotland's constitutional arrangements, whether we become independent or not, whatever powers the Scottish Parliament might have in the future, we want to make sure that Scotland is a good place to do business and is seen to be a good place to do business. So that's been the focus of the trip. And you know, beyond that, I'm always happy to discuss the issue of Scottish independence.
Thank you. From the floor. Gentleman over there. Could you please give your name, sorry, as well, before you ask a question?
Graham Souter. Good morning, Nicola. Would the Scottish Government, if it was an independent country, have business-friendly policies? And if so, how would that attract investment into Scotland, given the emphasis of your trip being on economic focus? The sort of political disruption, if you like, it was always one of the things that investors are quite nervous about. Before they make investments into different countries and economies. How do you see that transition over the next few years, assuming, you know, in your view, Scotland would become independent?
Okay, thanks, Graham. An important question. Just as a bit of context before I answer that question specifically, you know, we were told often in the run-up to the referendum that the very act of looking at this question and having a referendum would deter investment from Scotland. There's not a shred of evidence that that has been the case. In fact, there's evidence to the contrary. We have an annual survey study published in Scotland by Ernst & Young, the attractiveness survey that looks at foreign direct investment into Scotland, and it showed that the year spanning the referendum was one of the most successful years that we've had, and actually suggested that the increased international profile that came from the referendum helped rather than the referendum hindering that. And Scotland is the most successful part of the UK, with the exception of London, when it comes to attracting foreign direct investment. So there's no evidence that the referendum had that deterrent effect. In terms of business friendliness, I lead a devolved government. We strive to be business friendly and to make sure that Scotland is a good place to do business, that we have a business friendly environment. We control right now very, very few levers of taxation, for example, but the one area of taxation we do control is the local, what are called in Scotland, business rates that businesses pay. We've got the most competitive business rates regime in the whole of the UK, signalling that we want businesses to see Scotland as a good place to locate. Now, if we had more economic powers, if we were independent or had a more powerful Scottish Parliament in this respect, we could use those levers more strategically and tactically. You know, for example, if we had control over the main business tax in the UK, corporation tax, we could use that to incentivise the particular areas of the economy that we wanted to focus on. And these would be levers that would allow us to demonstrate our business friendliness, but also make sure that the areas of the economy we wanted to grow, the areas that were strong and we wanted to boost, or the areas that were weak and we wanted to strengthen, we could focus on them. And it's like anything else in life. The more tools you've got in your toolbox, the better job you're going to be able to do. And effectively, that's what greater powers or independence is all about. It's about equipping us in Scotland to fulfil the ambitions that we've got as a country.
Thank you. Eric.
Good morning. My name is Eric Wishart. I would like to ask you, with the large Conservative majority in Parliament, how do you see the role of the large SNP bloc? How can you have an impact in Westminster?
Again, Eric, good question. I think we're already seeing the impact of the large bloc of SNP MPs. I mean, the first point I would make is the Conservatives do have a majority in the House of Commons, but it's not a large majority. It's a majority of 12. Now, Margaret Thatcher used to have majorities of upwards of 100 in the House of Commons, so it's a very, very slender majority. And already we've seen the Conservative government having to retreat on certain things where they weren't confident of being able to maintain that majority. So, you know, I mentioned the European Convention on Human Rights. The Tories want to repeal the Human Rights Act in the UK. They've had to back off of that, put it into the long grass, because there are members of their own party who are not happy with that, and they couldn't be confident of a majority. They had to postpone a vote on relaxing the ban on fox hunting a couple of weeks ago. On EVIL, the English Votes for English Laws, they've been sort of forced into retreat on that. So they will have to be very, very careful about their majority. And we're already seeing through these examples the might of a big group of MPs from Scotland that can exert influence and make their presence felt. There's been lots of commentary, and this is interesting, been lots of commentary in the UK media since the election to the effect that suddenly Scotland's got more MPs in the House of Commons. Scotland has exactly the same number of MPs in the House of Commons that it did before the election, 59. It's just that it feels as if there's more, because we've got a group of SNP MPs that are down there to make Scotland's voice heard. So instead of having a big group of MPs who go down there and are never heard of again, we've got a Scottish bloc that are there to represent Scotland's interests, and that impact is already being felt.
Thank you. Back to you.
Julian Stargard. Welcome to Hong Kong, and thank you for a splendid speech. In his victory speech, David Cameron said, quote, "In Scotland, our plans are to create the strongest devolved government anywhere in the world." I'm sure you've reminded him of that from time to time. Here in Hong Kong, we are privileged to enjoy a very high degree of autonomy, including complete fiscal control. We set our taxes. We keep our taxes. Would you envisage a devolved government and parliament in Scotland which might bear similarities to the basic law that Hong Kong is privileged to enjoy?
I would like to see a Scottish parliament that had the fiscal independence of the type you describe. It's not what is currently on offer through the proposals that the House of Commons are currently considering. Just in brief, what is proposed right now is to give Scotland responsibility for pretty much, not completely, but pretty much all of income tax. And the block grant that Scotland gets from Westminster would be reduced by the amount of income tax that we're able to raise. But every other tax, business taxes, for example, VAT, although we'll get some assigned revenue from that, but the ability to set rates, all of that remains reserved to Westminster. I mean, at the heart of why I support Scotland being an independent country is what I said in response to Graham. It's the ability to shape the kind of country you are through the policies you're able to implement. And the more of those levers you hold in your own hands, the more you can influence your own destiny. No country's success is cast in stone. No country has the automatic guarantee of being economically prosperous and successful. But my belief is the more control you have over the decisions you take that influence that, the more successful you're likely to be. So, you know, it's often said there are two kinds of nationalists in Scotland. There are what are called existential nationalists, people who think Scotland's a nation, ergo we should be independent. Now, I understand and respect that, but I've always been more of what is described as a utilitarian nationalist. It's about what you can do with the powers you get to create a better society in which to live. And the more economic powers Scotland has, the more we can grow our economy, grow our revenues, and be more economically successful.
Thank you. Over there.
My name is Mark Michelson. Thank you for being here. I'm excited by some of the things you've said. I want to follow up on the investment side. I used to work in that area for the Hong Kong government. In addition to making a business-friendly environment, specifically what areas are you looking at and how much does the government get involved with it? For example, you were at the Science Park yesterday developing that carbon, the carbon business, which is quite exciting. Is the government involved with facilitating this? And if so, how are you going to do this looking to the future, maybe in this or another area?
Well, in relation to the last part of the question, yes, the Scottish Government is involved principally when it comes to international investment through an arm of our economic development agency, Scottish Development International. The gentleman here at this table, Julian Taylor, heads up SDI in this region of the world. So if anybody here is interested in knowing more about it, Julian will be happy to talk to you afterwards. The Scottish Government will use our influence where we can. We'll use our financial resources to facilitate and encourage investment into Scotland. In terms of the areas, I mean, we'll consider any area, but what we've very deliberately chosen to do as a country is focus on the areas, A, where we have comparative advantage, and secondly, where there is real growth potential for the future. So for Scotland, that will be energy. You know, our oil and gas expertise is well known, but increasingly it's our expertise in renewable energy, in low-carbon technology. So the initiative I helped to launch yesterday at the Science Park involves our universities. SDI has been involved in that. Food and drink is a real growth area for Scotland. Textiles, I was hosting a reception last night promoting our textile industry, our fashion designers. So, you know, these are life sciences, digital technology. These are the key areas that we're focusing on because we think we've got comparative advantage there and we're being very successful, but we want to do even better.
Thank you. I think we have time for two more questions. Francis at the back.
Let me step up where I can be seen. Thank you. Francis Moriarty, I'm writing for The Economist, freelancing. You're going to be meeting, I believe, with the acting chief executive, Carrie Lam. We have a number of people in Hong Kong who do not have Hong Kong does not have the option that Scotland has of opting out of its arrangement. But a lot of people would like to do that, or they have sympathies for those who do want that. Will you be discussing, first of all, what will you be discussing with her? And secondly, would you have any suggestions for her of how to deal with people and what might happen if people's desire for greater independence and control over their own lives is thwarted?
We'll be discussing a range of things, I'm sure, this afternoon, principally some of the economic, trade and investment opportunities that I've already spoken about. I will be very interested to hear from her what the next steps in the political reform process might be. I mean, my view of this is actually the same as the view of the United Kingdom government. I think a transition to universal suffrage for the election of the chief executive is an important part of securing the stability, the prosperity of Hong Kong in the long term. And I very much hope that we can see a renewal of that process and a restarting of dialogue that leads to that, and I'll be interested to hear her perspective on that. In terms of people's desire for more democracy and for more autonomy, you know, it's not my place to come here and tell Hong Kong what it should do or what it should think about these matters. I wouldn't, you know, take kindly to somebody from Hong Kong trying to dictate to Scotland. So, you know, I won't presume to give advice to a politician here in Hong Kong. But one of the things that, you know, I learned from the referendum experience was the power of democratic engagement. And what I would say is that democratic engagement has to be that democratic, peaceful, lawful. You know, I'm very proud, amongst other things associated with the referendum, of the fact that Scotland has had for generations and centuries, culminating in the referendum, this, you know, passionate debate about whether we should be an independent country, and not a single drop of blood has ever been shed in that debate. It's been entirely peaceful and democratic, and that's something we're proud of, but I think something that provides a lesson to the world. So peaceful democratic protest is fundamental in any society, and those rights have to be protected. The freedom of expression, the freedom of assembly, these are important rights for any society. So that's my view on these matters, and I look forward to discussing those issues as well, I am sure, as a range of other issues with Carrie Lam this afternoon.
Any final question, Anna?
Anna Fenton, former president of the club. I'm Irish, so I can ask this question. If Scotland is such a great country, why have we got so many jocks over here?
We've got quite a few at home as well, it's fair to say. Although, you know, to be fair to the spirit of your question, I was in the United States just a few weeks ago and often made the reflection that there are more Scots living there than there are living in Scotland. That's probably not quite true of Hong Kong. I think, actually, the fact that there are so many Scottish people, very senior Scottish people in business, in academia, in all walks of life, in all parts of the world, is actually one of the pieces of evidence for what an enterprising, innovative, go-getting country that we are. You know, there is nothing wrong with people from any country going across the world, sharing expertise, gaining expertise. Many Scots who go overseas to work will come home, not all do, but many of the Scots living here and in other countries are actually a huge asset to Scotland. The Scottish community in Hong Kong, I've been here now for less than 24 hours and I've seen the evidence of what the Scottish community here in Hong Kong do to spread the word about Scotland. So we're a talented population. You know, there was evidence published recently that says that Scotland has got the most highly educated population in Europe. Now that is a fantastic asset for Scotland at home and abroad. So I would see it hugely as a positive for the country, and we seek to utilise it as effectively as we can.
Thank you very much, First Minister. And I would just now like to present you with a small memento of your visit here.
Drink, but you share it, you don't drink at all.